Coppell's Western Cape Radio, CWCP, broadcasting from Worcester, South Africa.
Welcome to the Worcester Reports, a program of stories, Christian devotions, and music. Broadcast on CWCP, Coppell's Western Cape Radio.
South Africa, turn back to God. South Africa, turn back to God. South Africa, turn back to God. South Africa, turn back to God.
Hello, this is Tony Coppell. We were delighted this week to have the chance to re-interview Jan Buchanan, and this time for her to tell the remarkable story of the eventual success of the adoption of her daughter, Joy. I would like to introduce again, Jan Buchanan. She is an Australian missionary associated with YWAM. Jan, welcome to CWCP Radio.
Thank you, Tony.
The reason I wanted to talk to you is because something really unusual, I believe, has happened in your life that our listeners would be very interested to hear about. You have a mature ministry working mainly in one of the Worcester townships called My Father's House. But 10 years ago, you began caring for a baby black girl who'd been abandoned. This is unusual. What are the circumstances in which it came about?
Okay, well, first of all, in 2004, I was involved in the Asian tsunami. And one of the big impressions I had of that were of the number of children who were killed. That had a tremendous impact on me. I was a teacher, I was a mother, and I saw these children and there was just nothing that could be done for them. And 2 years later, I was speaking to the Lord about what I should do with the rest of my life. And he impressed on me to come and work with children in Africa. Now, I didn't know exactly what form that was going to take, so I came and I joined YWAM here. But I actually gradually developed a vision for working with children affected by or infected by HIV/AIDS, and particularly AIDS orphans. So when I came over here, I believed that I was actually going to start a number of homes for children affected by HIV/AIDS. So it wasn't really surprising that I actually ended up with a child. But at the time that I got her, I wasn't really looking for her. I was actually doing children's ministry in Worcester Hospital, and I went along into the children's wards, and I was talking to the mothers and helping them and praying for them. And the nurses said to me that there was a little baby who they thought had been abandoned. And so they said, would I like to just mother her a little bit? Her mum hadn't been there for 4 to 6 weeks. It wasn't the first time that she'd been in the hospital. She'd been there several times, and each time she was dropped off, and then her mum would appear 4 to 6 weeks later and pick her up. So I took this little baby and I carried her around with me and kept on with what I was doing. But all the time I was carrying her around, I actually started carrying a sling and, you know, carrying her next to my heart in a sling. And a few weeks later, the sister said to me, we think this baby has been abandoned. Would you like to actually foster her? So I said, okay, I'll pray about it. And I did. And the Lord said, yes. But at the time, her mum actually came back and took her away. So I wasn't able to take her at that time. That was about September, I think. Anyway, a few months later, it was actually the 24th of December. YWAM had finished for the holidays, and I got a phone call from the social worker at the hospital, and she said, that little baby's back in hospital. She's been here for a month, and we are desperate because her mother's given her up for fostering. And we can't find anyone to take her. Would you like to take her? So I said yes. And that's how I got Joy.
You just said, I said yes, like it was a sudden decision. But I have a feeling it's from your previous association with this little baby, you developed some close affection for her.
Yes, I certainly had. I was actually expecting that she would be the first of maybe six that we would have together in a foster home, and I was thinking that I would be able to have a lady coming and looking after them. I was told that I would be paid a SASA grant to look after Joy, so that should have enabled me to actually pay for somebody to look after her. But everything fell down. Within a month, they actually said I couldn't legally foster her and that they wouldn't be paying me any SASA grant. So I've had it for 10 years and I've never had any SASA grant. So I haven't been able to employ anybody else. And also, because I didn't have permanent residence, they said they wouldn't allow me to legally keep her. And so I wasn't able to take any other children. So it was very, very different from what I'd actually expected it to be.
Did you feel to some extent you were jumping off a cliff?
Yes, within about a week when I realised just how sick this little girl was. She's got a chronic illness, which was life-threatening at that time. We got her onto medications that she'll be taking for the rest of her life, but she nearly died several times. She had pneumonia several times within the first 3 months, and I had to go into hospital with her. It seemed to be over weekends, so quite often I'd be in there sleeping on the floor under her bed, actually. But after about 3 months, the medication kicked in and she has got better and better.
So at this point in the story, how old is her? Her name is Joy. Let's introduce her. How old was she?
She was 11 months old at that time, but she was very, very far behind her milestones. At that stage, she could just sit up, she could hold her head up, but she couldn't even crawl. So I spent quite a few months crawling around the floor, teaching her how to crawl and helping her to, you know, get, you know, back with children of her age. And she was about 16 months old when she actually started to walk.
Now, you already had a daughter at this stage. How old was your natural daughter?
My natural daughter, Lexi, was about 28 at that time, so she's 38 now. But she's living in America, so we don't often see her. But she accepts Joy as her own sister.
Now, you did mention Joy's birth mother. Have you been able to discover anything about the mother? Do you have contact with her? And has she attempted to contact you at all?
I didn't meet her mother. I met her particularly at a time when she had been given an ultimatum to come to the hospital and pick up Joy by the Friday afternoon. They'd been searching for her for about 2 weeks, and she was told to come or Joy would be fostered out. She didn't come by the Friday, so they contacted me and said, come and pick Joy up. So I went in on the Monday, all prepared to bring a baby home from hospital. But Joy was dressed in going home clothes already, and her mother was there with her. So I had a chat with her mother, and I could see that there was not very much bonding there. I was actually very, very upset because of the lack of bonding. But I recognised too that her mother was in a very, very difficult situation. I found out later that her mother had no ID. She was from the Eastern Cape, which meant that she had never received much education and she couldn't get a legal job. So just looking after a baby and providing her with the food that she needed was extremely difficult for her. And so I do understand why she ultimately gave Joy up for adoption. And I also believe that she felt that Joy was going to die. Joy was very, very sick at that time. And so she didn't want to watch her baby die. She actually very kindly left Joy in the best place where she could get the best possible care. And she met me and she specifically asked for me to take Joy several months later when she gave Joy up for adoption. And so that's why they actually looked for and found me.
Now, as I mentioned at the start, you are a professional missionary, if that's a fair term. You have other duties, and motherhood is a 100% thing. How did looking after this little baby impact other aspects of your life at that time?
It was a tremendous struggle. First of all, it was a week. I got Joy a week before I was going to start doing the family ministry school at YWAM, which is a full-time university course. So I hired a lady, a black lady, so Joy would feel comfortable with her. It would be more normal for her. And this lady, she was at YWAM, and she looked after Joy in the mornings while I was at YWAM studying. And then I was mother, full-time mother, in the afternoons and at night. But as I said before, Joy was extremely sick. And for the first 3 months while I was trying to study, I would very, very frequently be woken up several times during the night, not just by the normal baby things of needing to be fed and things like that, but by an extremely sick child with a temperature of, you know, 40, 41 degrees. And several times I took her into hospital and they taught me what to do. But after they'd shown me that I could put her, wrap her in a wet sheet and put her feet into ice water to bring her temperature down, then they said to me, don't bring her in anymore, because you can do everything that we can do. And it was extremely difficult because a number of times I thought this child was dying. But I was very blessed to be living with some close friends, Trish and Brian Dobson. I was living in a flat at their house, and many times I would knock on their door at 2 o'clock in the morning and I would say, I think this baby is dying, please pray for me. And that was a tremendous support to have them pray over her. And it is true, the prayer of faith does bring healing to the sick.
So Joy has been living with you ever since as your daughter. And I know how much you love and you care for her. But tell us what this period of quite a few years has been like, the period, the mother-daughter relationship, the sick child. I now see a child that looks perfectly well to me, although I know that she still has medical problems. But tell us about those years of bringing her up in your home here.
Well, she's been a tremendous joy to me and a real blessing, because I'm a widow and the Bible says that God puts the solitary in families, and that's really what he did for both of us. So it's been a blessing not only for Joy but very much for me as well. But it was also tremendous frustration, because a month after I got her, the social workers told me that because I didn't have permanent residence, I couldn't keep her permanently. And then I didn't hear anything more from them for 18 months. And then they sent me a letter saying, we need to sort out this child's future. Please come and see us. And at that time they said, well, we recognize that you are bonded and we won't take her away, but you can't have her. So then I didn't see them again for several more years. And then just before she was going to school, I realized that I didn't have any birth certificate and I didn't have any right to actually go and get a birth certificate, because I'm no living relation of her and I'm legally not her guardian. So it was tremendously difficult to even find out where she was born. I assumed she was born here in Worcester, but the hospital social workers were extremely helpful in helping me to find all sorts of details. We never did find her mother again. We know she's left Worcester. And they actually helped me to find out where she was born, and I was able to, after a lot of struggle, I actually got her birth certificate. And that enabled her to go to school, and without that, and because I had no legal right to get that, she wouldn't have been able to get any schooling, and her fate would have been very, very similar to her mother's. So that was a very, very difficult situation. But again, she's grown up very, very well. I'm tremendously blessed by the doctors that we have at Worcester Hospital, and particularly that quite a number who have treated me have been tremendously committed Christian doctors who actually pray over her. Private doctors with private practices as well, who will pray over her and bless her. And this has been such a wonderful thing to me, to be cared for by these doctors. And doctors who don't just treat me like a mushroom, but will share information and teach me about her sickness so that I can give the best care that I possibly can to her.
Tell us about Joy's schooling. Did she go into the regular school system?
I found it very difficult to get her into state schools. There's not always a place for children. So I ultimately put her into Lanner House, which is a Christian school. And I was tremendously blessed by that as well, because they were very, very small classes. And Joyce had quite a few reactions to her medications, and some of them actually meant at that time that she had great difficulty in waking up in the morning, and sometimes she would actually fall asleep in class and things like that. Often she had difficulty in getting to sleep at night, and she wouldn't sleep until 11, and so this would have an effect the next day. So the teachers at her school were tremendously loving and caring and very, very understanding, and that made a really big difference to both of us.
Is she a good student?
I think so. She does very well. Occasionally her marks have come down quite a bit, but very often this has to do with her medical condition, and she's had some complications at times. But as soon as we get on top of that again, then her marks go up again.
I think that recently you've started homeschooling her. What was the reason behind that?
A couple of different reasons. One big reason is that during the last year, I've had some tremendous blessings, and that the first one is that I got my permanent residence after I applied for it 4 years ago, and that meant that I could apply to actually adopt Joy. I discovered that with just fostering her, I wasn't not able to take her out of the country, and so I've adopted her so that very soon I'll be able to take her back to Australia. With YWAM, every 2 years we're allowed to have a 2 month furlough when we're able to go back to our families in my case in Australia, and we also visit a lot of the churches who are supporting us. And each time I've done that, I have had to leave Joy in Worcester, and very often it's difficult to find somebody to look after her appropriately. And also it's very traumatic for Joy as well, because it deepens the sense of abandonment. And so I said 4 years ago that I would not leave again until I'm able to take Joy with me. But it's difficult as well, because my dad is 93, turning 94 this year, and so I really need to get back and see him. So we're going to be travelling for several months to Australia, but also my daughter has just finished her PhD in America, so we're also going over in June to America to attend her graduation, and particularly to go to a lot of museums. And that will be part of her homeschooling.
You mentioned adoption. I was going to ask you about that. How smooth has the process of legal adoption gone?
It went much more quickly than I had expected. I got my permanent residence in May, and very, very quickly I had an appointment with a social worker down in Paarl, a private social worker that I had to go through, and she was absolutely wonderful. And it only took a couple of months before, I think it was the end of September, that the legal adoption was completed, but we still are waiting for the papers to come back from Pretoria. So it could take another 2 or 3 months for that.
Let's look towards the future. You're going to be retiring from the mission field in a few years. How's that going to affect Joy's future? How do you see her looking forward?
I'm praying about that, because in actual fact, the word retirement is not found in the Bible. I notice that people like Caleb at the age of 80 entered the promised land and said, "Give me this mountain." And Moses actually did his greatest work for God at the age of 80. And my father at the age of 93 is still on the board of a Christian school in Australia. So I'm talking to the Lord about this. I do have concerns about the fact that here I'm bringing up Joy as a fatherless girl, and that has a tremendous impact on girls. And although I've had some people who've fathered her to a certain extent in the past, it would be really great to have close family members who can father her as well. So I'm praying about the possibility of taking her back to live on my father's farm, where there are 3 or 4 other families with children the same age and several men who can be like father figures and uncles to her there, and that could solve this problem. A girl gets a lot of her self-esteem and her understanding of her role as a woman from her father. And Joy has never actually seen parents problem-solving together and trying to overcome difficulties. And this is something a girl really needs to see before she goes out and forms her own family. So I'm praying about that. But again, one of the biggest problems is whether or not the medical care in Australia would be good for her, because there are relatively few people in Australia with her medical condition, so a lot of the doctors don't have the experience that doctors in South Africa do have with this situation. So when we go back to Australia, we're going to be exploring a lot of these situations and also praying about what God really wants us to do. So we only want to follow God's plan for our lives.
Oh, I've actually got the privilege of talking to Joy herself, and I know that listeners will have been wondering what sort of a girl this is. Your mum has told us how you came to be living with her, which was about 10 years ago. So Joy, at what stage did you understand that your mother wasn't actually your birth mother?
I can't actually remember when. All I know is that I knew, but I can't remember when.
Joy and I have always been very, very open and honest about her origins and the fact that I'm not her birth mother. And I made a point when we travelled through Verleersdorp, where she came from and where she lived, of looking around and saying, I wonder where your birth mother is and I wonder what she's doing. And I explained to her about the difficulties her mother had. So basically she has always known and always understood that. And it's very important too, because secrecy is one of the most damaging things when a child is adopted.
So how's childhood been so far? Because you don't ever remember a time when you weren't living here with Jan. Have you had a good time as a child?
Yeah, great.
Are there some things that you particularly like or you particularly love to do? Some passions?
I like doing my soccer and my karate.
Karate? I wasn't expecting you to say that. Are you a good karatean?
Yeah.
What kind of a belt are you, or however they measure those things?
I'm an orange belt, and I was a yellow belt last year.
So I don't want to have a problem with you on a dark night.
No.
Is there anything that you would like to change about your life at the moment?
Not really.
Good answer. Looking to the future, do you have an ambition, something that you'd like to do when you've finished your education?
I would like to travel the world and study animals.
Let's hear a little bit more detail about that. Do you want to be a medical person, an animal doctor, or do you want to study them in the wild, or what?
Study them in the wild.
I can see you out on a safari, I really can. Do you want to get married?
Yeah, when I'm older.
I like that answer too. Okay, thank you, Joy, very much for giving us a little insight into your life, which is a little unusual for other people, but it's perfectly usual for you.
Just going back to Joy coming to terms with the fact that I wasn't her birth mother, one interesting thing was that when she was in grade R, they used to draw self-portraits every week. And for quite a few times, I noticed that she was drawing herself with blue eyes, whereas she obviously has black or dark brown eyes, and occasionally she would draw herself with red hair. So she was obviously looking at me and relating the pair of us together. So it took quite a number of years before she actually drew herself accurately. So that was quite interesting.
This is indeed interesting. I'd like to thank both you, Jan, and Joy for talking to me here on CWCP Radio. I'm hoping that in years to come, listening back to this interview will remind you of a few things, what it was like in the beginning of 2019. Thank you both, and God bless you.
Hi everyone, it's Lorianne. We're going to give Ways to Grow in God a week break because I really am unwell. Can't even sit down to record or write. So instead, Tony's going to have something a little different, and we'll be back with Ways to Grow in God next week.
And something different is actually an excerpt from the wonderful book Legacy by Jasper Kloete. Legacy paints a brand new concept of personal financial planning and business financial planning for that matter, and shows a new way of going about handling our money. And I have made a recording of the preface, the introduction, and the first chapter, because I wanted you to discover why this is so special. And I think even just the first chapter will help with that. Legacy is available on Amazon in Kindle format or direct from the author as a soft cover book. And the author's name again, Jasper Cloete, Cloete. So here is my reading of the first chapter of the book, preceded by the introduction. Legacy by Jasper Cloete. Preface. By buying this book, you have taken the first step to take your family on a journey from struggle to significance. In this book, you're going to rediscover an ancient truth that, if you apply it, will turn your family into the next generational family and bring you to a place of abundance and rest in your lifetime. This book is essentially about the generational inheritance group, GIG, movement, and how it all started. It shares the lessons learned on the way and cast a vision for a future three-generational mindset world. Jasper's life journey brought him to a place in 2016 where he became a specialist in the template that could turn ordinary one-generational families into the next extraordinary three-generational families. To maximize your value from this audiobook, it is recommended that you listen to it once, just to grasp the total message. Let the members of your household also listen to the book. Have a discussion and agree to start the process of building your family fund. Then go back to the book and use Chapter 9 as your guideline in this process. I believe the content in this book will revolutionize your life and have a dramatic impact on the wealth and well-being of your family for generations to come. Let's start the journey. Introduction. Someone once said, to be an overnight success, you had to start 30 years ago. I always wanted to be successful, and it is therefore appropriate that my personal story and the story of GIG, the Generational Inheritance Group, started more than 30 years ago. At the time of beginning to write this book, I was already in my 60s and beginning to fret that I had not yet achieved the level of wealth and success that others seemed to have achieved. Yet, as I looked around, I realized that many in life were looking up to me as though I were their definition of wealthy and successful. This set me off on a journey of 6 years to learn how to measure success differently. That journey forms the foundation and development of GIG, the Generational Inheritance Group. I now have the rare pleasure to share the revelations and message of GIG that has so profoundly reshaped my view of life and business and allowed me to see just how blessed, wealthy, and successful I really am, with unlimited potential for continuing growth and for leaving a significant legacy for future generations of my family to come. I sincerely believe and hope that my journey can do the same for you too. Legacy. Chapter 1. As Poor as a Church Mouse. A story of personal and family struggle confronted by almost everyone in life and business. I grew up the eldest son of a pastor, one of five children in a home filled with love and prayer, but often low on material resources. How my parents made it, I don't know. But with little material resources and lots of wisdom from God, they raised five children, paid off their own house, and when my dad passed on at the age of 85, he left my mum debt-free and taken care of. There's a joke amongst pastors that the assembly prays, "Lord, you keep our pastor humble, we will keep him poor." Watching my parents convinced me that being a pastor was definitely not a good career move, measured from a worldly wealth perspective. From a young age, I had a desire to be wealthy and prosperous so that I could look after my parents, family, and siblings. I started to take on part-time work whenever I could find it, and from the age of 13 earned my own pocket money and bought things for myself with my own money. In the environment I grew up, the popular thinking was study, get a good job, work hard, and you'll live happily ever after. I studied with an educational bursary and completed a BSc honours in chemistry. A condition of the bursary was that I had to do a one-year teacher's diploma. It was during this year that I met Helen, my wife, who also studied to be a teacher. This was the only good thing I got from all my years of study, a wife according to Proverbs 31. We got married in my last year of study, and a year later my bursary was bought out by Arms Corps, and I started to work for them at Somchem, a manufacturer of propellant, in Somerset West, Western Cape. I soon realized that I didn't fit in with the strict semi-government culture where the different management levels were not supposed to mingle. I continued my studies part-time during my MBA, which I finished in March 1982. Helen still had to work off her educational bursary, and since we considered starting a family, we were looking for something that she could do from home whilst still adding to the household income. In 1981, whilst doing a month's military training, I met a friend, Llewellyn Dolman, who together with his wife, Krishna, became a major influence and lifelong friends in our lives. On the 23rd of December 1981, they introduced us to the Golden Products opportunity. This company has since merged with two other international companies and became GNLD, operating in 50-plus countries. See www.gnld.co.za. Coming from a strong academic and management background, I was very negative initially about joining GNLD, but happy that Helen should pursue this opportunity. I've since learned that most men have very fragile egos. They hide behind their fear of failure by pretending they're too important or busy. When they see a new opportunity with strong potential, they push their women in front and get them to try it. If the wife then doesn't succeed, they tell their friends, "Women, what do they know about business?" If the wife succeeds, however, they soon position themselves as the partner so they can tell their friends, "My wife and I have a successful little business." If the business becomes very successful, they then push the wife aside and tell their friends, "I have a business." That was what happened in our GNLD business. Initially, Helen operated it, with me still studying and observing her. Soon she started to advance and even started to travel overseas, so it became our business. For the first 9 years of our GNLD business, I was still a full-time employee climbing up the corporate ladder. In my case, I ended up climbing it for 12 years, only to find that my ladder was leaning up against the wrong wall. After 3 years with Somchem, I moved to Johannesburg and worked for the Industrial Development Corporation, IDC, where I learned how to analyze the business model of large companies and how to restructure them in terms of funding opportunities to ensure sustainable growth. I spent 4 great years with this institution when the entrepreneur in me got restless and I jumped at an opportunity to become involved in a new company that produced interlocking bricks for the low-end housing market. I quickly learned that having the theoretical knowledge of business and experience in a large established corporation does not prepare one with the ability to start a business from scratch with limited resources. Due to technical problems and with the manufacturing process, this business failed within the first year of startup, and I found myself unemployed and in debt at the age of 32.
By that time, I was the father of two boys aged 4 and 2 years. I had to sell off a rental property and a stand to settle my debts. This experience taught me one valuable lesson, however, how to protect your family assets through a trust. For the next year, I did consulting work for small business and was on contract with the Small Business Development Corporation, SBDC, now the Business Partners. I experienced firsthand the challenges of trying to build up a professional practice whilst trying to be the chief cook and bottle washer. Struggling to get payments from the clients for whom I consulted became my biggest headache. We survived this period with the income Helen brought in from our GNLD business. I spent the last 4 years of my corporate life with the SA Housing Trust. They have since closed down. This was a government initiative towards the end of the previous government, pre-1994, to provide housing for people in the townships. The Housing Trust would develop the land in terms of infrastructure and provided the loans for housing. I advanced my career rapidly, and at the end of my corporate journey was overseeing a department in charge of hundreds of millions of rands in assets. Then came the end of the previous government, and I became one of the statistics of highly qualified men being retrenched. This time, however, I was better prepared. I was in a privileged position to foresee the retrenchments coming 2 years before it finally happened to me. Initially, I was in shock that everything that I had dedicated my life to building a career in the workplace, was all in vain. The greatest shock came when I realized that all my years of studies and getting degrees and building my professional CV still only meant that I could build a CV in the hope that someone else, somewhere out there, would find me employable. They didn't. I went into a state of quiet desperation and disillusionment, and for about 6 months became extremely negative and full of self-pity. All this happened while I was still employed, but I was personally involved as part of senior management in the first round of retrenchments and saw the cold-bloodedness with which it happened. Until this period in my life, I was quite happy for Helen to pursue her GNLD business, which I considered a part-time housewife kind of business, assisting her after hours while I pursued my corporate career. Then towards the end of 1989, I found myself in a state of desperation. I accompanied Helen to a GNLD weekend function in Plettenberg Bay. That weekend turned my life around. I heard testimonies from people who left their professional careers as medical doctors, attorneys, farmers, and pastors to become successful in GNLD. My eyes opened up to an opportunity that, if I applied the same level of professionalism that I had applied in my corporate career, could give me an alternative career, independent of politics and not limited by location. I saw a way that I could build a legacy for my family and one day provide alternative careers and business opportunities for my sons. Once I changed my attitude and made a decision, taking the action became easy. There is a saying, until the why is sorted out, the how doesn't matter. Since I know that retrenchments at work were now a definite prospect, I committed to a part-time working plan where I worked after hours from 5 p.m. to 11 p.m. every day, plus Saturdays, to build our GNLD business. I read all the books that were recommended, listened to all the CDs, then still tape cassettes, and developed all the necessary skills that would make me successful in this new career. I further submitted myself to be mentored and held myself accountable to the leader of the organization, Charlie Bolton. I also had regular counseling sessions with my friends, Llewellyn and Krishna Dolman, and whenever possible, mixed with leaders who were role models in the industry. When I was finally retrenched in September 1992, I was mentally and emotionally prepared, and I was already following a proven work habit and action plan. For the next 2 years, I worked systematically to build the team and find the right people. when the 1994 elections happened and South Africa became the darling of the world for a season or two, our South African foundation was in place for international expansion to happen. Our breakthrough came when I met a man from Rwanda, Gerald Zirim Wabagabo, who brought his family to South Africa to pursue new career opportunities. He used to work for the United Nations on contracts, but felt he needed to bring more stability into his family life. A friendship developed, and through him I became close friends with another great gentleman, Professor Alex Ngamwama Baguma. He was from Uganda and lectured medicine at the University of Transkei. Together with these two gentlemen, I was invited to take the GNLD opportunity to Uganda in 1994. For the first 6 months, I had to become an exporter from South Africa and set up as an importer in Uganda. The need for packing space resulted in us buying the neighbor's property. From planting the business in Uganda, it rapidly spread to Kenya and then Tanzania. Once the business potential in these countries was proven, GNLD moved in and set up its own warehouses and local offices, and I was relieved from having to export. The house that was used as office and packing space was turned into a small guest house in 1997. It started off as a small three-bedroom bed and breakfast. In 2002, an adjacent property came on the market, and we could then start the process to have all three properties consolidated, rezoned, and have a conference center and further guest rooms built. Today, Eagle's Nest Lodge and Conference Center, see www.eaglesnest.co.za, is a well-known landmark in the heart of Four Ways and is used by many companies and business people for conferences and accommodation. What started as a vision for my family at that weekend function in Plettenberg Bay in 1989 has become reality for our family since my wife Helen and my eldest son Henry are now managing this part of our family business. By 2003, we've achieved many milestones in GNLD, an organization of over 20,000 people in more than 12 international markets. We've traveled overseas more than 50 times and started to enjoy a quality of life for our family. I became restless, however, and needed to find the entrepreneur in me, and in March 2003, started an entrepreneurial group called REWARD, Rising Eagle Wealth Associates Taking Responsibility for Their Own Destiny. This was the period that the books of Robert Kiyosaki, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, became very popular. I imported the game, Cashflow 101, and started to play it with a few friends. The game creates a great environment to stimulate one's entrepreneurial spirit. After the game, we would discuss the elements of being an entrepreneur and how to escape the rat race and asked ourselves, why don't we play this game in the real life? We then started a public company, sold shares, and invited people to come and learn business skills in a practical manner after hours while keeping the security of their jobs and careers. In a short time, we had over 50 shareholders and invested the money into buying property with the idea to develop it or sell it. Then the property market in South Africa crashed in 2005, and we couldn't sell any of the properties, yet still had the bonds to pay. Initially, our cash flow from shareholders helped to pay the bonds. Then one by one, their situations deteriorated and they dropped off, no longer able to help pay the bills. The situation kept on deteriorating, and in the end, only 7 of the initial 50 shareholders remained. We were forced to close the company down, sell off all the remaining properties at a loss, and were able to refund shareholders a small percentage of their original investment. One good thing out of this experience is that we also helped some of our members to start their own businesses. One success story was Mrs. Doris Matsweni. At the time of starting to work with us in 2007, she started a nursing placement business in Johannesburg. She initially funded it out of her pension fund payout. But by the time she placed 15 nurses per week with a monthly salary bill of 70,000 rands, she ran out of cash and could no longer fund the growth of her business. By restructuring her company into a private corporation, we could attract investment that funded her growth, and by 2012 she bought out the investors and became a 100% family-owned business again. At the time of writing this book, her company is providing jobs for more than 1,500 nurses per month, spread over 5 major hospitals, with a monthly salary bill of more than 4 million rands, and the business is funding its own growth. Her story is one of the stories that is shared in our introduction video that can be watched on www.gig-institute.com. What this experience with Reward taught me is that the sustainability of an entrepreneurial organization is only possible where people take personal responsibility for growing their wealth. Another major influence in my life happened in 2005. A friend of mine invited me to an ICCC, International Christian Chamber of Commerce, conference, www.iccc.net. I was introduced to a movement of international businessmen who saw their business and workplace as a ministry platform to expand the message of the kingdom of God in the marketplace. I had the privilege to serve on their South African board from 2007 to 2009 and to attend some of their international conferences in Jerusalem, Israel. With an international footprint in over 104 countries after 25 years, it gave me a glimpse of the possibilities if people can work together and trade with one another from a common cause and mindset. Before I continue, I need to introduce you to a concept that I call my doily principle. A doily is an ornamental mat, typically made of fabric and used to be placed over milk or juice to keep flies away. I want you to visualize a doily, round-shaped cloth with beads on the edge for weight and decoration. Now lay your hand on a flat surface and spread your fingers out and imagine this is that doily. Visualize the line of each finger pointing outwards as one of the components of your life, where you pursued a career in a specific area until the door closed for you in that area. Then, via another finger, you pursued the next opportunity until that too fizzled out. Every time you have to come back to the beginning to start all over again. Looking at your spread out hand, you cannot connect the dots. The tips of your fingers do not touch. And from a career track record point of view, you may even feel a failure. To illustrate what I mean, let me share with you my career. When I reviewed my own career in 2008, I tried to make sense of my personal and professional journey, but struggled. I started off pursuing an academic career with all my energy. Then that stopped. Then I pursued a corporate career with all that I had, only to be retrenched in 1992. I pursued an MLM career from 1989 until present, but realized there was something bigger waiting for me. I pursued our entrepreneurs group Reward with all I had until we had to close the business in 2008. I pursued the activities of the ICCC in South Africa and international with great enthusiasm until 2009. I'm still a member, when I sensed a different calling on my life. The one thing that kept coming back to me and bothered me was, why do people start a new project with such enthusiasm and vigor? But as soon as the struggles come, the people who swore they would be there to the end just disappeared, and it was left for a handful of people to see the project through. In March 2008 in Uganda, whilst training leaders on the importance of thinking long-term, the gig message came to me. I realized then that all the problems we experience in our current society are the result of a one-generational thinking mindset. We have become the me, my, and I society for now. It's all about what's in it for me now. Decisions are made from a short-term perspective. I then discovered that this situation was already addressed over 4,000 years ago during the time of King Solomon when he observed, A good man leaves an inheritance of moral stability and goodness to his children's children, and the wealth of the sinner finds its way eventually into the hands of the righteous for whom it was laid up. Proverbs 13:22, Amplified Bible. When analyzed and understood within its correct historical context, which we will do in the next chapter, this wisdom has the potential to revolutionize communities and countries economically with enduring wealth. Earlier, I asked you to place your hand on a flat surface and extend your fingers and imagine it represents a doily. I shared with you my own story and how my various experiences initially did not make sense. Now I want to take your other hand and with your fingertips pick up the hand by the skin on top of your hand. Let the fingers of the hand that you picked up relax and make contact in the air. Your fingertips now connect. Imagine yourself picking up that doily. In the air, the spiritual realm, all the beads now touch and connect. This illustration is to show that every person on earth goes through experiences that do not make sense initially. At the right time, however, through an event or a change of circumstances, they are confronted with their true purpose, and in pursuing that purpose, they find that all the experiences they've gone through now fits properly into this final purpose. That's what happened for me in 2008. I found my message and my purpose, and GIG and all its related businesses came into being. The first 3 years, 2008 to 2011, were spent trying to understand the difference in thinking and behavior between the masses, trapped in one generational mindset, versus the thinking and behavior of the few multi-generational families we find in each society, and whose family businesses contribute to a major portion of the national economy. After 3 years and sharing the message to many people, only about 12 people took the action and started to implement the lessons we've learned. From this humble beginning, the need was identified to own our own bank, and in 2011 we started the GIG Cooperative Financial Institution, www.gig.coop. which at the time of writing this book, we are in the final stage of getting registered as a corporate bank. The purpose of this book is to introduce you to the concept of generational inheritance and to open your mind to the incredible opportunities such a mindset could open for you, your family, and your community. I hope to inspire you not only to read the book, but to take the next step and start your own 100-year generational action plan for you and your family. In the process, you will join the GIG movement, and your eventual story and success will help to make the movement strong and spread the message internationally.
Koppel's Western Cape Radio, CWCP, broadcasting from Worcester, South Africa.
Google Generational Inheritance Group, and you'll find a lot of information about GIG, including local events in GIG clubs. And there's a GIG club probably in your nearby city where you can obtain copies of Legacy. For the last 10 days, Lauriane has been suffering from boils and a carbuncle. The carbuncle's on her backside, the boils are on her abdomen. And it is so painful that she's not been able to sit down, which is why you haven't heard her Ways to Grow in God in this episode of the Worcester Report. This morning, our friend Rihanna Van Wake called her just to see how she was getting on. and mentioned that she had seen a brand new video of a song from Bethel, which Lorianne might find helpful in her situation. And indeed, we did. I'm going to play that song. It's called Raise a Hallelujah. And it's available on the Couples in Western Cape Facebook page. And I strongly recommend you go there and play it on a laptop computer plugged into good speakers. Although you can hear it on your phone, the experience is a parody of the real thing. I'm afraid it's one of my pet peeves, people listening to everything on their phones instead of hearing music and video in the way it was designed to be heard and seen. Please pray for Lorianne in her recovery. We think the worst is past, but it's very difficult for her. And thank goodness that it happened during the school holidays. Wishing you all well, we'll be back a week from now, and we ask God's blessings on all our listeners. Now, Bethel Music.
This year, as a Bethel Music family, a few days before Christmas, most of you guys probably were a part of this miracle, but we watched Joel and Janie Taylor's little son, Jackson. And he was, a few days before Christmas, airlifted to intensive care. And we began to fight for Jackson's life. How many of you guys joined in that fight and that symphony of prayer that rose up for a little boy? And a couple weeks into the fight, we got a text one night from Joel that they weren't sure if he was going to make it through the night. And as soon as I heard and read the message, it was like this giant of unbelief stood in front of me. And I just thought, Jackson's going to die tonight. We're not going to see the miracle. And as this giant stood in front of me, all of a sudden, out of my gut, this song started coming out. Right in the face of the giant. I raise a hallelujah in the presence of my enemies. I raise a hallelujah louder than. As that giant was looking at us, I knew he was going to regret the day he ever pointed his sword at Jackson. Just as Goliath pointed his sword at David, the sword Goliath pointed at David became the sword the little boy picked up and took the giant's head off with. And as we watched this miracle happen in Jackson's body, it was like this giant of unbelief was falling. And our community just began to sing this song. It was just one note in the symphony of prayer rising for his life. So I want to teach it to you this morning. Let's sing. I raise a hallelujah. My